Good day to our listeners. My name is Yusuf Sufi, and today I am joined by Sunera Thobani, professor in Asian Studies at the University of British Columbia. I'd like to begin with a land acknowledgement, one for the University of Toronto, where the Reading Muslims Project is based, and one for the University of British Columbia, which is the home institution of my guests. I wish to acknowledge this land on which the University of Toronto operates. For thousands of years, it has been the traditional land of the Huron-Wendat, the Seneca, and the Mississaugas of the Credit. Today, it is a meeting place still to many Indigenous people from across Turtle Island, and we are grateful to have the opportunity to work on this land. I also acknowledge that the University of British Columbia is on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. Welcome to our audience. This is a podcast, part of the Reading Muslims project, a Connaught Global Challenge project at the University of Toronto. My name is Yusuf Sufi. I'll be your host today. I am a researcher, a research associate, and the co-PI for the Reading Muslims project. And today we are very fortunate to have with us Dr. Sunera Thobani. Dr. Thobani is professor in the Department of Asian Studies at the University of British Columbia. Among her accomplishments is that she was the director of the Race, Autobiography, Gender, and Age Center, which laid the groundwork for a critical race studies program at UBC. This was between 2008 and 2012. She's also a founding member of Researchers and Academics of Color for Equity, Race, Canada, from 2001 until the present. Among her publications are Exalted Subjects, Studies in the Making of Race and Nation in Canada, published with U of T Press in 2007. And she also has a recent edited volume with U of T Press as well, called Coloniality and Racial Injustice in the University, Counting for Nothing, published 2021. Today, we are fortunate to be discussing her work, Contesting Islam, Constructing Race and Sexuality, The Inordinate Desire of the West, published with Bloomsbury Academic in 2020. Welcome, Dr. Thobani, Sunera, if I may. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course you may. And thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very thankful that you're interested in this book.
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of our mandates within the Reading Muslims Project is to question or to engage with questions of Islamophobia, anti-Muslim racism, and your work falls squarely within that category. So we're very excited to be able to chat with you today. Our audience might not know that we had a chance to meet a few years back when I was teaching at UBC. You came over to our house one evening, and with you there was several scholars that you acknowledge within your book. There is Itrat Sayed, Simi Ghazi, Fasil Nari, Chavlan Eren Guzgen, who you mentioned edited, substantially edited your work or worked towards the final proofs. When you came that evening, I had no idea that you were actually working on this, because this would have been in 2018. So you must have been in the last stages of getting it out at that point.
I was. And I was very thankful for that evening together. We met for the first time then, I believe. And, I was kind of really caught in the agony of trying to complete this work that had taken over my life for 20 odd years. One thing that I do mention in the acknowledgement is how, you know, what people think of as chance encounters have really connected me in such interesting ways to people who were working on similar things, similar topics, not always from the same perspective, but, evenings like that stand out in my mind as showing me how crucial a kind of different way of being in the world is to, shall we say, Muslims, but more than Muslims, to peoples amongst colonized communities. And it was just, you know, seeing the hospitality, the generosity being replicated in the many, many places where I have been fortunate enough to spend evenings like that. That really kind of kept me grounded as I was working on this book.
I completely understand what you're saying. When I read in the acknowledgments that, you know, the book came out of certain personal experiences, and we can get into those in a little bit, right after 9/11, I related immediately because there's so much, especially in those early years after 9/11, where just viscerally, like being in the world, you could see something was wrong, something was amiss when you were in different circles, even with intellectuals, even with people that you thought, okay, these are people who critically engage with the world, they critically engage with the state, they critically engage with power. This is going to be a space where we can discuss some of the problems about the war on terror, some of the discursive violence, some of the physical violence. And yet, oftentimes it was the opposite, that we were deeply, deeply frustrated and deeply saddened. I remember Edward Said mentioning something like that too, near to his death. He, in one of his last interviews, mentioning how he was surprised at how some people that he thought were colleagues, allies, quickly jumped on board with the Bush administration and the war on terror. And when you mentioned those evenings with people of color, with Muslims, with people who are critical of the state and of histories of violence more broadly, it's like it's kind of like a refuge where you can ground yourself again and say, yes, number one, the way I see the world is not crazy, despite the fact that the masses, the media, the politicians seem to be towing a different line. And also what I'm doing, the work. It's really important. It's really important. We have to keep going.
Yes. Well, I knew the work was important because it wouldn't let me go. But what was interesting for me was that people who were previously critical of the state, who studied histories of violence, somehow were able to disconnect all of their critiques, all of their, you know, understanding of the violence of the state, from what was happening to Muslims. And for me, that was shocking. You know, one would expect from, you know, colleagues who were liberal or even conservative, small c, that these alienations and ruptures would occur in relationships. But what was really shocking to me was how people who were really critical of the present order, who understood how violent the process had been of producing this order, were nevertheless willing to put all of that understanding, learning, knowledge aside and adopt this really Islamophobic framing of Muslims. That was the shocking part for me. Feminists fell into that trap. Anti-racist activists fell into that trap. And that I was not expecting.
Yeah, I mean, you have a whole chapter on feminism, you know, the contestations within feminism about how to respond to the war on terror. I am actually surprised, and perhaps in a bit, I want to introduce the book a little bit more before we get into the specifics. But in a bit, I'm interested in knowing how those studying race as well, you felt like they were not necessarily allies at that juncture, because I would have thought that might be a place where you would find more allyship. So we'll touch upon that in a bit. But first, I just want to introduce the book a little bit, and I want to give you the opportunity to introduce the book. So let me first say, so Contesting Islam, Constructing Race and Sexuality, The Inordinate Desire of the West. It's a study of how the identity of the West was and continues to be produced through Islam and Muslims. Your aim in tracing this identity formation is to give us a better understanding of the discourses that have positioned Islam against the West during the War on Terror. In other words, you examine historical discourses to shed light on the present. You build off of other authors that have made similar claims, such as Edward Said, Gil Anajar, and Jacques Derrida, but you distinguish yourself principally in your attention to sexuality and race in the West's self-construction. And it's very, those chapters on sexuality and race are very strong. They're very good. They're certainly an eye-opener for me. I want to give you an opportunity here to outline the main points of the book in your own words. What are some of the main themes you're grappling with? Who are the authors that have shaped your thinking on this subject? And what bodies of literature are you pushing back against?
So the main themes that I deal with in the book are Western modernity, sovereignty, and subjectivity, and the place of Islam, Islam as quote-unquote religion, Islam as quote-unquote a racialized religion, the place that Islam holds in the production of Western modernity, its forms of sovereignty and subjectivity. I'm also interested in the theme of colonialism, imperialism, and globalization, because I approach the West and Islam and Muslims as historicized phenomena, as historicized categories, forms of being in the world. So these kind of major phases in the development of Western modernity, colonialism, imperialism, globalization, you know, those become very important themes in the book to look at how they actually impact not only the process of Western self-formation, but also the production of Islam and Muslims in the Western imaginary. Gender and sexuality are also major themes because, you know, the intersections between race, religion, and gender and sexuality are foundational to the making of the West. So, you know, those are themes that I also track in the book historically. But I think overall, I would say the themes that I am really interested in studying in this book are the role of violence in the governance of Muslims at the global level, at the international level, in the contemporary moment, but also the historical kind of antecedents to the use of violence in the governance of Muslims. So those are the kind of main themes and issues that I was interested in studying in this book. The thinkers who have influenced my work the most are Frantz Fanon, Edward Said, Joseph Massad. You know, another really important influence is the work of Tomoko Masuzawa, who looks at the invention of world religions, Anidjar and Derrida, as you've already mentioned, but, you know, it was a kind of critical relationship with their ideas. And then, of course, Asma Barlas and her reading of women and Islam was very important in kind of shaping my own understanding. Maida Yeknoglu, who studies the kind of colonial construction of the veil and its relationship to feminism, that was also very influential. Leila Ahmed's work, Gender and Islam. And then also thinkers like Sylvia Winter, Hortense Spillers, and many other critical race theorists who have really deconstructed the idea of the Western man and how crucial anti-Black racism has been. So those are the thinkers who I think Dalal Asad would be another one. You know, their work runs, I mean, I'm so indebted to these thinkers. Their work runs throughout the book. Their ideas I found very productive, and I've tried to take them as far as I can in my own work.
Thank you. Yeah, so I have a question about the themes of subjectivity and globalization and empire. Throughout the book, do you think you're more concerned with the production of the West as this abstract category, or possibility of the Western subject feeling like a sovereign subject, or perhaps it's both? You know, at times you talk about how the white feminist finds her identity through talking about the lack of freedom of the Muslim woman. So is it more an abstract category of the West, or is it the individual subjectivity, sovereign subject that you're interested in, or is it both?
It is both, because I believe the two can't be separated. But certainly one thing my book is not is treating the West as an abstract category, or thinking about feminism as a kind of abstract category. My book really set out to historicize these categories. And once you start historicizing them, of course, you see how crucial relationships of power are in the construction of these categories. And these relations of power, of course, are organized through the state, through the forms of subjectivity that are associated with a particular formation of the state, and how the subjectivity of individuals, citizens, others, enemies, are all shaped in this kind of entanglement of power relationships. So, you know, I don't see the state either as an abstract category. I see the state as actively and crucially involved in the process of subject formation. The kinds of, you know, subject positionalities, for example, that are produced through state discourses, through state policies, they then become available to individual subjects to engage with, to contest, to claim. And so I see the process of subjectivity, subject formation, state formation as integrally interlinked and interconnected. I can't actually separate them in my own thinking and in the world in which I live. That's how, you know, I understand the making of power relationships. Of course, this perspective comes from my earlier work, Exalted Subjects, where I looked at how particular subjects are able to claim certain kinds of characteristics as their qualities of their humanity. So, for example, the idea of Canadians as compassionate, right? You know, immigrants are no less compassionate, perhaps even more so. Yet immigrants are not constructed as compassionate. It's part of Canadian national identity for Canadians to think of themselves compassionate, as humanitarian, all these kind of goodness that makes up human characteristics. And in my earlier work, I traced how at particular historical moments, these characteristics become the kind of key characteristics that define a particular population. So in the War on Terror, of course, the West was constructed as vulnerable, as innocent, Muslims as fundamentalist, fanatic, terror-oriented, violent. So I'm really interested in when these particular characteristics start functioning in the world, how they are encoded and embedded in structures of power. And, you know, with the War on Terror, we see state policies, right? I mean, the Bush administration's ideological construction of the war is that of Western cultural superiority, which includes gender egalitarianism. You know, now it includes egalitarianism in terms of treatment of gender and sexual minorities. So how do those characteristics actually become constructed? And my argument in Exalted Subject is this is how individuals get bound to the state, by constructing their own subjectivity through these discourses. So I've never been able to separate since that early work, state formation, subject formation. And of course, given my own particular history of migrations, multiple migrations, always having a kind of larger global perspective on these issues.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Methodologically, that seems very sound. The other thing that I wanted to ask is, going through your book again earlier this week, there's this interesting move where, on the one hand, you're dealing with the constructions of Islam, Muslims, and the West, and some of the you're historicizing those constructions, but you're also gesturing towards how Islam has continued up until the present to be a source for anti-colonial mobilization for Muslims. I found that very interesting, where there's the not just the attack on representation in the West, but there's also that gesturing towards, listen, there's something about this tradition. It's a complex tradition. It has its problems, but there's something about this tradition that has continued to inspire Muslims and inspire them to mobilize in various ways, some that we disagree with, some that we would find exemplary, mobilize in different ways against empire. I found that interesting. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yes, I would like to, but I'd like to begin by saying that this tradition itself is contested. So certainly if we can find histories of anti-colonial activism in this tradition, we can also find traditions of authoritarianism, of alliance with the most regressive forms of governance and state power. So, you know, this tradition itself is deeply contested, and it always has been. And this is where, you know, the work of Talal Asad, for example, and Salman Saeed, in thinking about this tradition as a kind of discursive formation, mm-hmm. so that there are continuities clearly, but the tradition itself is experienced, given shape, forged in particular historical context, in particular historical moments. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing that I was very interested in thinking through, because, you know, this idea that Islam is something, it's religion, it's static, it's fixed. Yet seeing, when I begin looking at the histories, that clearly the tradition is very contested. It has never been more contested than it is presently. So this idea of a kind of unitary Islam or Islamic tradition was something that, you know, I didn't find that a very convincing or persuasive kind of position. So certainly for me, the anti-colonial tradition is really important because, you know, in my own thinking about race, about feminism, about, the making of the international order, colonialism and the kind of moment of quote-unquote national independence, I've considered them as crucial to organizing the social order in which we now live. And, you know, I've been a big fan of Fanon's work. His theories, his thinking about race, his thinking about Third World Revolution, his thinking about how the colonial order was based on violence was very, very formative in my own thinking. Thinking about, here is Fanon theorizing race, Third World Revolution. He's doing it in totally secular terms, but he's watching, he's witnessing, he's part, and he's completely allied with the revolutionary Algerian movement, and the masses are Muslims. For me, you know, thinking through this tradition and what role it played, for example, in the Algerian Revolution, what role Muslims played in anti-colonial struggles in the South Asian subcontinent, for example. You know, and they played hugely important roles. Muslim women, for example, played a very important revolutionary kind of role in the Algerian Revolution. So, you know, for me, how could you separate the kind of Islamic tradition, the Muslim identity of these revolutionary figures from how we think about the tradition of Islam? So I really was very interested in thinking about. And then, of course, one finds a huge critique of Western colonialism in the earlier thinkers who are associated with political Islam. Islam, you know, the kind of politicization of Islam, Sayyid Qutb, for example, mm-hmm. has a very profound critique of Western colonialism, of its racism, of its gender politics, right? Ali Shariati, you find the same kind of critique. And so, you know, it became very clear to me that kind of this demonization of what is called political Islam had made many critical thinkers even oblivious to the anti-colonial strands that ran through the work of these earlier kind of thinkers. And of course, you know, Talal Asad, Salman Said, they all reject the kind of idea of, you know, political Islam, you know, by thinking about it as a discursive tradition that is fought over from many different theoretical perspectives and from very many different historical experiences. So, you know, and once I started kind of tracking those kinds of histories, it was very clear that you can't separate kind of, you know, what happens to Islam during the colonial period and in the post-independence period without thinking about the impact of anti-colonial Islamic politics in those moments, in those very kind of formative moments for the order in which we live today.
Yeah, and you know, one of the virtues of the book is grappling with kind of canonical anti-colonial or post-colonial theorists like Fanon, and then showing some of the limitations of their work too, right? So, so you show us how Fanon, despite his commitments, had a little bit of a had trouble grappling with Islam, right? He thought, you know, Islamic culture would kind of wither away after independence, or certain Islamic practices, at least, that didn't fit in with his understanding of modernity. So I think that's a very strong part of the book, is you're grappling with a lot of foundational theorists within different disciplines, critical race theory, queer studies, gender studies, post-colonial studies, but you're also pushing forward. You're also critiquing some of the weak points, some of the blind spots that they have.
Yes, and you know, on this point of limitations, you know, I consider, you know, these thinkers kind of giants on whose shoulders I stand. The limitations, if we call them that, are the limitations of their historical moment, and also the limitations of the colonization of our very thinking. And if we think about colonization as a kind of process that, you know, is certainly about economic, political dominance, but it's also about the kind of colonization of the psyche, colonization of the imagination. And Fanon is, you know, outstanding when he talks about what the destruction of indigenous languages have meant, how the destruction of indigenous language and culture is the process of the destruction of the historical being for themselves of colonized populations. And I think that we are all today products of these centuries of colonization. So how to even break through and to kind of start to, you know, grapple with how this deep internal colonization of Muslims is playing itself out in the contemporary moment was very crucial for me. And of course, Fanon's work as a psychiatrist gives us, you know, he comes up with brilliant insights into how this internal kind of colonization of the psyche, of language, of quote unquote subjectivity takes place. And so for me, you know, despite the limitations of many of these thinkers, they are indispensable to understanding the present moment. And of course, you know, secularization as a kind of, you know, the highest accomplishment of modernity, of humanity, continues to stay with us. And, you know, this process of the exaltation, if I might call that, of secularism begins many centuries earlier. And many of the, you know, anti-colonial thinkers are caught up in this narrative of modernity. Certainly they recognize that Western modernity is tied to colonialism and coloniality. But yet there is this kind of, you know, and it's a historical project of thinking about different modernities, you know, reformist movements, all of these are the kind, you know, the, all these movements and thinkers kind of speak to the politics of the moment. And that was a moment of intense secularization, which was then equated with human liberation. Yet, you know, we see that majority of Muslim communities and societies have never actually bought into that project. The westernizing elites did. You know, the elites that emerge as the kind of now intellectual, you know, interpreters, representatives of these Muslim masses are as invested in secularism as some of these earlier, you know, historical revolutionary figures also were. But the moment we live in is different, and we've seen the catastrophes wreaked in the name of secularism. And, you know, my understanding of the global war on terror was that it shifted global politics so that Muslims could only, you know, have the right to have rights, as Hannah Arendt put it, if they presented themselves as subjects within this secular framework, which means that Muslims had to present themselves as subjects to be saved by the West. It's only in that framework that Muslims become intelligible. By, you know, for example, arguing Islam is a religion of peace, right? And kind of reproducing the colonial constructs of religion and of how Islam has no place in the public sphere. It is religion and so clearly belongs to the realm of the private. Of course, this is how colonial governance was organized for centuries, right? And so for me, all of these kind of taken for granted assumptions about the superiority of secularism, modernization, development projects have to be really interrogated very, very seriously, because they've led us to this place of the global war on terror, where violence is the only modality of governance for Muslims who refuse to succumb or subjugate themselves to Western cultural values and Western intellectual projects. Violence is the only modality of government for those Muslims. If we look at the kind of, you know, environmental catastrophes, the, you know, that the war on terror has produced around the world, the destruction of the third world state, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, the destruction of what many of us believed, or many of us were critically kind of engaged in this idea that third world peoples had somehow found sovereignty or acquired sovereignty or inclusion into the Western liberal order in the post-independence period. The war on terror just completely tore that narrative apart.
Yeah, absolutely. It brought empire right back into focus again. Absolutely. So I want to, at this point, go back to our earlier conversation about the genesis of the book. So you mentioned that the book is a product of two decades of reflections on the war on terror, the global war, as you call it, throughout the book. You write in your acknowledgments that following the 9/11 attacks, I made a speech at an anti-violence feminist conference urging women's organizations to oppose the then looming invasion of Afghanistan and the war on terror in general. The hate lash that followed, a small taste of things to come, pushed me into a deeper and far lengthier study of the issues mentioned only briefly in that speech. This book is the result of that larger study. It has pulled me in directions I had never before imagined taking. There's a sense in which your historicizations and theorizations are an attempt at making sense of what viscerally and personally you experienced as deeply problematic ways of thinking about Islam, Muslims, and the legitimacy of violence after 9/11. In particular, you really take to task academics, even allegedly critical ones, who failed to take into account alterity properly during the war on terror, instead of taking refuge in Eurocentric theory that renders illegible Muslims and other people of color. Do you mind telling us a bit about this experience in the post 9/11 world? How was it being an intellectual speaking against war or simplistic depictions of Muslims at that time? And as a follow-up, do you think things have gotten better? If so, why? If not, why not?
Well, you know, I think that speaking out in that moment was very, very crucial. You know, it came with it its own costs, and I'm still paying those costs. You know, one of the things that happened as a result of my speech was that I was investigated for a hate crime. Somebody accused me of having engaged my speech being a form of hate crime against Americans.
Wow.
So, you know, and then, of course, there was the death threats and, you know,
wow,
all of those issues. So
where was the speech given? Do you
it
mind?
It was given in Ottawa, actually, okay, at a conference on violence against women.
Wow.
And so, you know, because of my previous work in the feminist movement, I was invited to, you know, give one of the keynote addresses there. And, you know, this was a moment in which the what I later call war frenzy was really building up. You know,
right,
there was a lot of public support for the Afghan invasion, the Afghan war, and this was a conference on violence. And one, you know, one could easily foresee what the consequences of this war would be for women in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So it seemed to me that there was no better venue than a conference on violence against women to, you know, mobilize the women's movement to refuse to support the global war on terror and the invasion of Afghanistan. You know, given my earlier work on race, post-colonialism, multiculturalism, feminism, I could see some of the historical continuities in the discourse of terror, of Islamic misogyny. I could see how clearly they were kind of re-articulating almost in the same language older colonial discourses of third world barbarism and cultural inferiority. I could also see how central the position of women had been to those earlier colonial projects and how central Muslim women now were to the global war on terror. So, you know, for me, it was astonishing. It was like, you know, being kind of plunged back into an earlier moment in history, because, of course, the British justified the colonization of the Indian subcontinent by pointing to what they defined as the degraded status of women in India. The French, of course, justified their occupation of Algeria by defining the status of Algerian women as that of being imprisoned, subjugated by Algerian men, their religion, culture, and society. So here we were again in this, at the beginning of the 21st century, plunged into the same kind of discourse and colonial constructs. And, you know, I guess I assumed that these politics would be obvious to feminists. But of course, there was a huge backlash against my speech. I was constructed as an apologist for terrorists. The Globe and Mail had a very offensive cartoon that they carried of my speech being projected into a cave somewhere with Osama bin Laden and other, you know, his companions sitting there listening to my speech.
Are you for real? Well, this really happened. Wow.
It really did. And so, you know, this kind of, it was a very, very, strange and in many ways scary moment. But anyways, for me, as an anti-racist feminist at that time, it was crucial that women stand up against this narrative, that feminist movements kind of, you know, refuse to participate in this global racial imperialist war. But of course, that didn't happen. Instead, feminists became as invested in the idea of Western cultural superiority as did the neoconservatives, the neoliberals in the Bush administration. So you know, that kind of really, for me, very early on became a very stark lesson of where we were headed in terms of gender sexual politics, in terms of anti-racist feminist politics. Even though the anti-war movement did begin quite early on, and there was some resistance to the war in Afghanistan, the invasion of Afghanistan, of course, this resistance really built with the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
But yeah. Afghanistan continued to be defended by feminists as the good war, mm-hmm. whereas Iraq was the bad war. And, you know, many people on the left took the same position. But for me, you know, the Afghan war was actually the kind of introduction to this larger remaking of the Third World that was part of the, and the remaking of the Middle East that was part of the Bush administration's larger project. So that was very, you know, a very kind of stark moment. And I could not unsee kind of what I was seeing happening in terms of this larger historical context. Have things got better? No, I don't think so, actually. Afghanistan and Iraq, these nation states have been destroyed, as have others. The whole Middle East and North African region are being remade. I don't know how we go back to a point where violence isn't the kind of driving factor in the remaking of these regions of the world. Militarization has escalated. We've seen the new forms of technology that were tied to the global war on terror and how quickly they have been disseminated around the world. You know, the role that social media continues to play. YouTube, for example, people forget that this emerged as a kind of fairly young platform in the early phase of the global war on terror. And if we look at what has happened in that, in kind of that sphere, I think it's really terrifying where the global war on terror has taken us. In terms of critical scholarship, I see the same reluctance to challenge the idea of Islamic, quote unquote, barbarity. I see a complete reluctance in terms of mainstream critical scholarship to interrogate the relationship between critical theory and the secularist modernization project. So unfortunately, I don't really see things getting better. You know, we've seen the kind of explosion of white supremacist movements and politics. The global war on terror opened that door to the rise of these white supremacist movements. And their project is very clear. They want to reinstate a global order that is based on white supremacy. And that has taken over the political landscape in most Western societies. In terms of the Indian subcontinent, for example, I don't think that the 2002 massacre in Gujarat would have been possible without the shift in the political climate and culture that the global war on terror accomplished, without its globalization of this discourse of Islamophobia, which then takes me to the rise of Modi and the BJP. I don't think that is separable from the impact of Islamophobia and the global war on terror on the Indian subcontinent. So unfortunately, I do not see things having got better. In fact, I think that we are headed for a much worse political period.
Sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, as a younger scholar, I do feel there's one way in which things surely have gotten better. And it's that I can't imagine having to face the type of hate lash that you faced in Ottawa at the early starts of the war on terror. So I agree with you in terms of the continuation of empire, the destruction of the nation states that you mentioned, drone technologies, Islamophobia being adopted in different parts of the world, while white nationalism being rooted in this discourse of the West and the threat to the West and who's the major threat to the West is the coming Muslim immigrant. I agree with you, but you know, it's almost as a compliment I want to give to you to my predecessors who had to endure this type of backlash, this hate lash. During the early days of the war on terror, because I, of course, had to face it in the sense of that discomfort that I talked about earlier in different social circles, including academic circles, including as an undergrad. I was in grade 12 when 9/11 happened. And so my undergraduate years were spent under the early years of the war on terror. So I remember experiencing that, but I never had to, nobody gave me the microphone to be someone to push back against it. And if I ever pushed back against it, it was in short essays read by professors, and that's it, not by a public. So a few weeks ago, I presented alongside Nadia Hassan from NCCM, National Council of Canadian Muslims, at a federal conference on Islamophobia and anti-Asian hate. And it was almost as though, you had a completely different posture than the one that you had 20 years ago, where they were listening to the ways in which CSIS and the RCMP and national security in general has committed excesses and abuses during the war on terror. And the format was such that they were very open to it. Now I don't mean to say that this is an actual shift in policy. I'm not trying to say that things on the ground have changed, but at least in terms of an openness to critical scholars, I don't have that worry. And I mean that as a compliment, like that. Okay. You and your generation pushed forward in ways that made it possible for later scholars. You mentioned people like Talal Asad, like incredible bravery, I feel, in those early years of the war on terror, for us to do the work, to continue the work now.
Right. Well, I'm really sorry to tell you, but I think you should be watching your back.
Okay, I will be. Okay.
In that moment, I have done this earlier work, both in my activism and in my scholarship, which kind of took this long historical perspective, I could situate my experience as not personal. It was a moment in which these histories were being fought out again to shape the present moment. And I think that the moment that young scholars like yourself are living in are different, but I don't think that you can understand this difference without seeing it as the result of the defeat of the American, Canadian, British occupation of Afghanistan. I don't think you can see this moment outside of the context of the global revulsion at the violence that was inflicted on Muslim bodies, Abu Ghraib, for example, right? So I don't think that you can think of these institutions and their representatives as suddenly having become enlightened, as much as they now have to clean up the mess that has been created. And, the liberal order has really depended on, for many centuries now, the integration of certain native elites into the colonial project. And, unfortunately, I cannot but see how strong that incorporation of young critical scholars, particularly Muslim scholars, has been into this narrative of Western benevolence. The kind of overt white supremacist construction of Western politics has been so thoroughly critiqued by critical scholars. But the Western liberal politics of incorporation, assimilation, collaboration, I feel that is where Canada, that's how I kind of situate Canada in terms of this global governance, that Western, the construction of the West relies both on this discourse of white superiority and liberal benevolence. And so, Canadian multiculturalism, for example, sits very well with the white supremacist politics in the US. And we see clearly the partnerships are there, the alliances are there. And so it is the power of the formation of the West in this particular moment that it can assume these different kind of, political faces, if we might say, And of course, this project now of listening to, responding to, you know, maybe even, I'm sure at some point in the future, we can look forward to apologies from the Canadian government, right?
Probably, yeah.
But if we look at these very institutions that you're talking about is wanting to listen, wanting to kind of acknowledge their, you know, excesses, nobody has been held accountable in the Western Alliance for the war crimes that have been committed in the global war on terror.
So if I were to sum things up, would you say that there's a bit of a, this posture is, number one, it can be traced to a longer colonial history where you try to incorporate voices of critique within empire as well. And also it's, well, not so much number two, but intertwined with that is it's a taming of those critical voices. Like those critical voices can exist, but there's a way in which when they get filtered to the state or the public sphere, they don't actually change much on the ground.
Well, you know, I don't think it's a posture. You know, I don't think it's a posture. I mean, one of the things that I theorized in Exalted Subjects was the different forms of sovereignty and governance that are coterminous, and particularly in the Canadian nation state. So for example, one argument I made by looking at this formation of the Canadian nation state was that Canadians, nationals of British and French origin, and who are now white Canadians, can actually experience the Canadian state as a liberal democratic state. That is their experience of it. You know, their rights are protected. They can make demands on the state. Immigrants have experienced, and I use immigrant as a category of racialization, have experienced this state as a very, you know, a promise of liberalism, as a state that embodies the promise of liberal inclusion. But at the same time, they have seen how their construction as immigrants continues to present them as outsiders, right? I mean, Canadians really love their immigrants to be grateful. And that's the position that we can occupy and become legible. Otherwise,
yeah, absolutely.
You're the enemy, right?
Yeah.
And Indigenous peoples continue to experience this same state as a genocidal state. So these different forms of subject of sovereignty and governance systems that can coexist, you know, kind of lead me to argue that it's not just a posture that is assumed. It actually speaks to a particular kind of experience within the Canadian nation state. But, you know, I mean, in terms of having to deal with Islamophobia, certainly, you know, what has happened in the US makes the liberal kind of political leaders and movements in Canada want to put some distance between them. And recognizing Islamophobia is one way of doing it. But this very same state and its institutions and its army and, you know, can still remain invested in militarization. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Islamophobia, you know, kind of being contrite over Islamophobia and, you know, regretting that it exists, blah, 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 can exist in the same moment as pro-Palestinian advocacy, for example, being defined as the new anti-Semitism, right? Mm-hmm. And so these discourses can coexist at the same time. And you can see how crucial both discourses are to the Canadian role, for example, in international politics, but in the Middle East. And yep. So, right, I think that we have to see how power operates.
Yeah, no, I think that's
all
fair.
Of these different ways and in different levels and in very different ways, which incorporates certain communities, certain populations into these discourses of the state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, the kind of Canadian multiculturalism, as I said, coexists very well with the Canadian investment, for example, in upholding the state of Israel
mm-hmm.
as a settler state in the Middle East. So both these can coexist. And it allows, in fact, the Canadian state to demonize pro-Palestinian solidarity,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's all of these, you know, different kinds of ways in which power is being reworked and reorganized. And without having the larger kind of holistic framework to understand these different configurations of power, I think that we're just at a terrible disadvantage.
I absolutely agree. When you put it that way. Sunera, I'm mindful of the time. We've had a wonderful hour to chat, but that's all I booked you for. I do have a couple of other questions relating to sexuality and race. It's up to you whether you wanted to tackle them or we could stop now. Even as it is now, we would perhaps want to trim the interview down a little bit because an hour is pretty long. So it's up to you. How do you feel?
Well, I'm fine. And then you can decide how you want to edit the interview and what you want to include and whatnot.
I think that's a good idea. Okay, so then let's do the next two questions on race, on sexuality and on race. Yeah. Okay, so Sunera, a central claim of the book is that Muslims have historically been an object of desire and revulsion for the West. It's a very interesting claim. Chronologically, you begin with the idea that Latin Christendom, particularly during the Crusades, positioned Islam as its enemy and in so doing constituted its own identity. But you also note that from the beginning, preoccupations about Muslim sexuality were at the core of the Western fascination and disgust about the Muslim. The Muslim was depicted as lustful and therefore symbolized the peril of sexuality that the medieval Christian needed to avoid and in fact reject for his own salvation. Over time, views about Muslim sexuality have changed, but they continue to be central to how the West understands Muslims and itself. It is also central to justifications of violence against Muslim communities. Can you do two things for our listeners? Number one, can you run by us some of the changes you note that take place historically in the understanding of Muslim sexuality and relatedly Muslim gender norms? And two, can you tell us how this analysis highlights some of the pitfalls of white feminism today? What does white feminism miss when it ignores this history of the sexualization of Muslims?
So as you note, you know, the issue of sexuality and gender are very central to the kind of early Christian response to Islam. And, you know, this begins with the representation of the Prophet of Islam, for example, right? You find the early kind of descriptions focus on, you know, the quote unquote sexually kind of excesses and the sexually debauched qualities that are projected onto the Prophet of Islam. You see, you know, comments about, you know, he's kind of something as trivial as he's wearing the color purple as a kind of sign of his effeminity or femininity. So you see how the Prophet himself gets constructed in this particular kind of way that sexualizes both him and the tradition that he is founding. So in this early period, which lasts through the Crusades, right? Islam and Muslims are seen as sexually degenerate, as debauched. The Prophet himself is constructed as the Antichrist, as lascivious and with insatiable sexual appetites. We see some of those discourses being reproduced in the present as well. So Muslims are defined as satanic by virtue of their sexual degeneracy. And we should remember that during this period, sex and sexuality are kind of treated as sinful, right? And Christian chastity depends on the kind of control of sexuality to be channeled only into reproduction. Otherwise, it is sinful. And so, you know, sex, sexuality themselves become constructed as sinful in this worldview. The way to Christian, to salvation is through sexual chastity. So the Muslims are considered as, you know, satanic through this linking of what is constructed as their sexual excesses, sexual depravity, sexual debauchery. And this considers right through the Crusades. This continues right through the Crusades. And the condition of sinfulness, the condition of kind of, you know, sexual, we might say, activity is seen as embodied by the satanic Muslims. And Christians during the Crusades could atone for their sins, including their own sexual kind of failings, through killing Muslims. And so sexual kind of salvation for Christians becomes equated with the hypersexualization of the figure, particularly of the Muslim men. And, you know, kind of it becomes a legitimating factor in organizing this mass violence against Muslims during the Crusades. So that's how this kind of discourse begins that I track in the book. During the colonial era, again, we see the idea of sexuality is so central to how colonized peoples, how the Orient, how the Oriental as the figure of the Muslim is constructed. So, you know, Edward Said kind of gives us a way to think about it, because Edward Said kind of does mention how the Orient itself becomes constructed as a place of sexual excess, sexual depravity, the harem, you know, all of those kinds of discourses Muslim men having access to untold number of women in their harems that they keep imprisoned. And so the construction of the Muslim as the Oriental during this period is also a sexualized construct. And it is in the construction of the Orient in feminine terms, as, you know, dormant, passive, that we see colonialism and Western masculinity being defined as the historical agent that will kind of, you know, discover, penetrate, conquer the Orient, all in the kind of quote-unquote project of bringing these Orientals into modernity. And, you know, discourses continue with development. The development project builds on the same kind of ideologies. So sexuality and gender are crucial to the kind of how the Orient is imagined. Of course, in the post-colonial period then, the post-independence period, what we see is this desire to modernize Muslim families. The introduction of the nuclear family, teaching Muslim women domesticity, child rearing. This all starts in the colonial period, where white women go as governesses, as, you know, educators to teach Muslim women domestic sciences, how to, you know, just to take a step back, during the colonial period, controlling access to the Muslim women is seen as the key to controlling the colonized society. And so the Muslim woman becomes a target. Her kind of, you know, sexual civilization, her adoption of Western gender norms, which are essentially bourgeois middle-class norms that come from the West, becomes crucial to the project of modernizing the Muslim world. And in the post-independence period, of course, Muslims take on this project themselves, right? Sexual excess, sexual barbarism is projected onto the lower class of Muslim women, uneducated. And that kind of discourse we see even now among Muslim feminists who, you know, want to kind of, who produce themselves as properly gendered, civilized sexual subjects, emancipated in the terms that are considered normative in the West, will project this kind of, you know, sexual excess, gender nonconformity amongst lower class Muslim women. They need to be educated. So Muslim feminists have taken this project onto themselves in the global war on terror. After 9/11, we see how the sexual gender politics really kind of coalesce around the anti-hijab, the anti-veiling projects that feminists take up. And, you know, the use of the trope of the veil, of the hijab, as confirmation of the kind of sexual barbarity of Muslim men becomes very crucial. The veil is a sign of hyper Islamic patriarchy. And, you know, I kind of use the work of feminists like Joan Scott, who argue that the project of de-veiling is really about making Muslim women sexually accessible to the West. The kind of discourses that we see around the veil today as hiding who the real Muslim woman is. Is she a suicide bomber underneath this veil? All of these have long-standing kind of historical antecedents where veiling kind of made the Muslim women unavailable to Western colonial administrators, to Western feminists. And so this idea of unveiling the woman, Muslim woman today, which is very much part of the project of modernizing Muslims, is invested in making Muslim women subjugate themselves to Western gender norms and sexual practices, but also to make Muslim women available to Western feminists, for example, to Western educators as a way to de-radicalize Muslim communities. So, you know, I think that what I do in this book is to track how the issue of sexuality, gender is so crucial to the forms of governance of Muslims, to the wars, early wars on Muslims during the Crusades, to the colonial era, where modernizing and saving the colonized Muslim woman or the colonized, quote unquote, Indian woman becomes central to the politics of colonial control, administration, domination. We see the same thing in Algeria, to the post-independence period where modernizing the Muslim family, modernizing the Muslim woman, monogamous marriage, a nuclear family structure becomes a sign of modernity, of Muslims modernizing themselves and hence entering into this space of freedom, liberation. And, you know, we're right back there, as I said, with the global war on terror. But what was also very interesting for me was to watch the images that came out of Abu Ghraib, the photographic record, to see how much the Muslim body, and of course, the photographs we saw were of Muslim male bodies, not women bodies. There are photographs that apparently do exist, but haven't been made public, of the sexual torture on Muslim women. Just looking at those images and seeing how the Muslim body was, Muslim male body was presented as abject. And yet you could not kind of get away from seeing the look of pleasure on the white women prison guards who were engaged in this process of terror. And I argue that, you know, we see here an image of Western desire for the Muslim body. And for me, I look at how the early kind of crusader discourses of Muslim sexual barbarity and sexual excess had now been transformed into Muslim repression, sexual repression. And then, of course, that being used to kind of, construct Muslims as sexually frustrated and hence prone to violence. So at one point of history, you know, we have Muslims are overly sexual, overly kind of, sexually debauched, and that demands that they have to be disciplined. This continues through the colonial era. And then we, after the kind of, in the post-independence period, we see that Muslims are now constructed as sexually repressed, and they have to be taught emancipation through the adoption of Western gender norms and sexual practices.
Yeah, it's a complete reversal of the script.
It's a complete reversal, right? Yeah. But the reversal, of course, speaks to the kind of emergence of feminist politics, of queer politics, right? That have really kind of redefined the meaning of the West in many ways. Mm-hmm. Feminists and queer theorists, even when they critique the West, they see the kind of promise of gender sexual liberation in purely liberal individualist terms as still a promise, even if it's not real, that's embedded within Western culture and Western civilization. Whereas Islam for them, has just no room for this, right? The construction of Islam is homophobic, Muslim communities as homophobic. And of course, Joseph Massad's work has shown historically that's just a kind of Western myth that has been constructed. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's a very long and kind of, very rambling answer to your question, because there's just so much to kind of.
No, I appreciate it, Sunera. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for historicizing that for us. So my last question is that another key part of your work is that alongside sexuality, religion and race are essential to the construction of the Muslim and Western identity. Can you tell us how religion and particularly race figure into your analysis? And would you mind also, you mentioned at the beginning how even critical race theorists were not always allies at the start of the war on terror. Can you speak to that as well as you answer these questions?
Right. So in terms of the relationship between religion and race, with the global war on terror, we saw how states, including in Canada, adopted racial profiling in the governance of Muslims. It's not that racial profiling did not exist previously, it did, but it was not legitimized and sanctioned by the state or, you know, within public discourses. You know, the racial profiling of indigenous peoples, for example, which preceded 9/11, racial profiling of black men and black women, for example, again. But this was something that was not part of state policy, even though in practice it was, it could not be publicly sanctioned. But with 9/11, the racial profiling of Muslims became state policy. And it was publicly sanctioned and had much public support, even amongst liberal and feminist constituencies. So I became really interested in thinking through how race and religion were being fused here, that the bodies that were being profiled were black and brown bodies. And so Islam itself was being racialized through these particular kind of policies and the kind of imaginaries that they then set into motion. So I started to track kind of what is the relationship between race and religion. And of course, that takes me back right to this earlier period when I was looking at how Muslims are constructed during the Crusades. And clearly, we see discourses of racialization are very much part of how Muslims are being constructed in the Western imaginary. So I started to think, what is this relationship between race and religion? At the same time, you have the kind of, if I can call it, the Europeanization of Christianity and the Westernization of Christianity that subsequently takes place. So that at a particular moment, Christianity becomes associated with whiteness. And Islam becomes associated with Semites, with, you know, the Orient. The discourse of the Orient is also a discourse of racialization. And so, you know, I could see how interchangeable was this relationship between race and religion. And most anti-racist theorists kind of focus on race, but do not look at the issue of religion. The whole construction of race is tied to the scientific discourses, biologically determinist discourses of race that emerge within Europe. But, you know, what I could see was that these scientific and biologically determinist kind of discourses of race were rooted in how Islam had been constructed in the Western imaginary, and how Muslim bodies had been constructed. The forms of abnormality, the kind of barbarisms that were associated with the Muslim body brought together these discourses of race and religion. So then I started to kind of track historically at what moment do we see this kind of separation between religion and race, right? And what does it entail, this separation? So earlier representations in Muslim Western political, philosophical, and cultural discourses, we see this intertwining of race and religion as the West gets constructed as European white Christian. And so let me just track this historically. So in the earlier period, we see the Muslim is constructed as antichrist, pagan, blasphemer, and is described in languages of the Blackamoor, the Saracen, right? These are all discourses of race. Pagan is also a discourse of race in this period. And Anya Lumba has done a really fantastic job of tracking what she called the early modern discourses of race, where these categories, the Saracen, the Blackamoor, speak to a kind of racial designation, not simply a religious one. And so I see how these discourses persist into the Crusades and the Reconquista, actually, after the Crusades into the period of the Reconquista. And Walter Mignolo argues that race emerges as a discourse in Europe at this time with the expulsion of Jews and Muslims from Andalusia. And he argues that the Spanish kind of developed this idea as race being carried in the blood, right? And this becomes the basis for the kind of biological determinist constructions of race. But what I could see was that even in this period of the Reconquista and the expulsion of Jews and Muslims, you know, the earlier discourses during the Crusades have already racialized Muslims, right? Muslims are seen in their very being, right? Discourses of evil that are associated with blackness, discourses of monstrosity that are associated with blackness. These were already in circulation during the Crusades. And so I argue that, you know, at different moments we have seen kind of, you know, this race and religion is co-constitutive, but also depending on the historical circumstance, race comes to the fore or religion comes to the fore. And so one of the arguments I make is that once Europe starts colonizing, particularly the Americas, and Christianizes indigenous populations, Christianizes the kind of black enslaved communities that have been brought from Africa. Once this process of Christianizing starts, there's very little to distinguish, right? Within the Christian framework, in terms of the status of the slave and the master, the status of the indigenous and, you know, the settler, right? Because if they're all Christianized, there is kind of some common basis. And it is at this point that race moves to the fore and religion falls into the background. And it is here that we see the construct of whiteness emerge, and Black Christians are constructed as Black first and Christian later. The same happens with indigenous populations. And so one of the arguments is, of course, the kind of colonization of the Americas, the transatlantic slave trade, the genocide of indigenous peoples makes it impossible for kind of, you know, religion to be the primary a marker of difference, because these populations are also being Christianized at the same time as a form of their governance, right? And so I argue that race then becomes kind of the dominant factor in constructions of alterity, monstrosity, difference, but that Muslims have already been subjected to this in this discourse in the previous centuries. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of my trying to link the kind of discourse of race with the discourse of religion with regard to Islam. In the Reconquista, as I said, the Muslims are constructed as Saracen, Blackamoors. In the colonial period, then it's Orientals. Orientals, Turks, this is the kind of language, Semites, this is how Muslims are constructed. And these also are discourses of race and religion. And then, of course, in the present, we see Muslims being constructed as jihadis, hijabis. These are also discourses of race, not just religion. So, you know, I think that a lot more work needs to be done in this area. I feel that, you know, some of the work I've done is very kind of preliminary in this sense. A lot more work needs to be done. But certainly, you know, the argument that race and religion are mutually constituted, they're constitutive of each other in the ratio, the kind of Western politics of self-identification, self-formation. And it's striking that, you know, Western countries identified themselves as Christian countries right up to the Second World War, right? Europe was Christian Europe. So how does this change? What does this mean? Of course, there is also the discourse of the whiteness of Europe. So Europe kind of signifies Christianity as well as whiteness. And that this self-definition kind of continues right up to the Second World War. So then, of course, I look at the kind of rupture in this relationship between race and religion that emerges in the Holocaust and in the Nazi camp, where we see that after this moment, it is the Muslim who becomes thoroughly orientalized. And one of the arguments I make is that European Jews then get accepted into whiteness after the Holocaust. And it is the Muslim then who gets racialized as the figure of both religious and racial degeneracy. The Muslim becomes thoroughly orientalized, the Jews become deorientalized and integrated into whiteness, and the Muslim then becomes constructed as the kind of singular figure of anti-Semitism.
Sorry to interrupt you. No, I was just thinking, you know, increasingly scholars are accepting and embracing the idea that Islamophobia is a form of racism, it's an anti-Muslim racism. In fact, I know several scholars who feel more comfortable using the term anti-Muslim racism than Islamophobia at this point. But I think one of the virtues of your book is to, you said it's preliminary, but it's still it gives us some depth. You know, it gives us some depth to understanding how it is that Muslims came to be constructed as a racial category, right? So it's one thing saying, you know, Islamophobia is a form of anti-Muslim racism. It's another to say how did it become that way? How were Muslims constructed as a race? So I think that's one of the great strengths of your book, and I would recommend anybody who is working on Islamophobia and is interested in thinking about Islamophobia as a form of racism to read it, and particularly to read the chapters tracing the relationship between whiteness and Islam, Christianity and Islam, secularism and Islam, and how they relate to stereotyping of people.
If I can just make one point.
Absolutely.
I'm really interested in this book is to think through how it's not only Muslims who are racialized. It is Islam itself that is being racialized. And so, you know, the definition of Islam as terroristic, as hyper-misogynist, hyper-patriarchal, hyper-homophobic, all of these are infused with racializing discourses, concepts. And so, you know, one of the points that I found a little bit frustrating is how after 9/11, you know, there were communities of color that built alliances with Muslims on the grounds of this kind of anti-Muslim racism, right? And came together to defend the citizenship rights of Muslims. But without really picking up the other part of this equation, which is so central to the racialization of Muslims, is the racialization of Islam itself that has been ongoing for so many centuries now. And so I think it's really important to also pay attention to how it's not only Muslims, it's not only black and brown bodies, right? I mean, critical race scholars have argued for a long time that race cannot be reduced to phenotypes, just black and brown bodies, right? That the discourse of race actually constructs different levels of humanity, right? The discourse of race is not a discrimination of, it's not a discourse of discrimination only and inequality. The discourses of race is really about constructing the dehumanization of racialized communities, so that it is white Christian who stands in for the man with the discourse of feminism. It is white women who come from, you know, this long kind of Christian background in terms of their civilizational construction, their political, philosophical construction, who stand in for woman, right? and then the feminist. And so it is this equation of Christianity, whiteness, with the status of the human that discourses of race actually produce. So when we look at discrimination, when we look at inequality based on race, we're just looking at the tip of the iceberg. What discourses of race really do is construct different orders of humanity and the dehumanization of people who are produced as racially degraded as a very condition of their being in the world.
So Nara, can I ask you a follow-up there, just a quick one, and then we'll wrap things up. When you say there were communities of color that came out in support of Muslims, but that were not attuned to the way that Islam itself had been racialized, what type of support or allyship would take into account that a tradition has been racialized? Like, what would be needed for that type of solidarity?
Well, that type of solidarity would have to interrogate its own investment in secularism.
Oh, okay.
Right? And one of the points I make in the book is this kind of fear of religion coming into politics, which has been so pervasive in Western political theory for the last couple of decades, is really an anxiety and concern about Islam entering the political sphere. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So for example, you know, you can have the Jewish state in Israel, right? And that is still not considered a religious, right, state, even though citizenship is based on that kind of condition. We can have, you know, Christian fundamentalists, you know, intervening in political parties. They control, you know, the kind of, and yet this state or the Supreme Court in the US is not seen, right, as a kind of place for religious politics playing themselves out. And yet Islam is kind of, you know, seen as a particular kind of existential threat for invading the space of politics. Modi's kind of Hindutva project in India, right? Based on the idea of Hindu supremacy, and yet it continues to be defined as a democracy. And so we see that this kind of anti-religion discourse is really directed towards Islam. And so I think that political allies, and God knows we need them, need to interrogate, as do critical scholars, their own investment in secularism, so that the Muslim who is being subjected to torture, mass execution, drone wars, you know, all of the kinds of violences of the state, is not only a black and brown body, but it's also a body that allies itself to the Islamic tradition.
No, I understand now. I understand. As soon as you mentioned the interrogation of secularism, intuitively, I understood just from thinking about where you can find at times solidarity, you know, anti-war movements, et cetera. But nonetheless, even with that solidarity, like a certain discomfort with the Islamic tradition. So, I understand completely what you mean now. So let's wrap things up there. Okay. So Nara, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today for this conversation and for enlightening our audience and for discussing your book, Contesting Islam. So Dr. Thobani is professor at the Department of Asian Studies at UBC. She joined us today to discuss Islamophobia and her book, Contesting Islam, Constructing Race and Sexuality, The Inordinate Desire of the West, published with Bloomsbury Academic in 2020. Thank you so much, Dr. Thobani.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your interest in my work and for giving me this opportunity to speak on your program. Thank you.